Alex, and sequencer lights on the horses' yokes, the whole package. A crowd had gathered around him. All the dudes were like, "Whoa!" And all the girls were like, "You're so awesome!" "It's no big thing," Epiphas told his admirers. "His Majesty, that would be my dad, he pretty much gives me whatever I want." Maybe you've known a few princes, or dudes who think they're princes. They can be jerks. Inside, Phaethon boiled with jealousy and anger because he knew that Epiphas's chariot cost more than most people would make in a lifetime, and in a few weeks, the prince would get bored with his new toy, and it would end up gathering dust in the royal garage. Epiphas let his groupies take turns holding the reins, feeding carrots to his horses, or triggering the retractable blades on the wheels. "It's the best chariot in the world," he said nonchalantly. "Nobody has one better, but whatever." Phaethon couldn't stand it anymore. He shouted over the crowd, "It's garbage!" The crowd went silent. "Who said that?" the prince demanded. Everybody turned and pointed at Phaethon, like, "Nice knowing you, buddy." Phaethon stepped forward. He held his head high, despite the fact that he was wearing a safety helmet with reflective decals. "You call that the best chariot in the world? It's a hunk of junk compared to my father's chariot." Epiphas raised an eyebrow.
"You're Phaethon, aren't you? The one with the 7 cute babysitters? I mean, sisters? You live in that, humble house by the river."
The spectators snickered. Phaethon was handsome and reasonably smart, but he wasn't popular. He had a reputation for being arrogant. Also, he didn't make many friends at school because his mom would let him participate in sports, at least not without a helmet, full padding, a life vest, a first aid kit, and a water bottle. Phaethon kept his eyes on the prince. "Epiphas, your dad may be the king, but my father is Helios, the god of the sun. His chariot would melt yours into a slag heap." He spoke with such confidence that the crowd backed away. Phaethon did look like a demigod. He was tall and muscular, with the upright bearing of a charioteer. His bronze skin, his curly dark hair, and his regal face made it seem possible that he was telling the truth. His anger even made his eyes glow with internal fire. Or was that a trick of the light? Epiphas just laughed.
"You, a son of Helios? Tell me, where is your father?"
Phaethon pointed to the sky. "Up there, of course, driving his chariot."
"And he comes home to your hut on the river every night, eh?"
"Well, no."
"How often do you see him?"
"I've never actually seen him, but..."
"So how do you know he's your father?"
"My mother told me." The crowd began to laugh again. "Oh my gods," said one of the girls. "So lame," said another. Epiphas ran his hands along the custom bronze detailing on his chariot.
"Your mother? The same lady who makes you wear that stupid helmet everywhere?"
Phaethon's face stung. "Concussions are serious," he muttered, though his confidence was faltering.
"Did it ever occur to you," said the prince, "that your mother is lying? She's trying to make you feel better because you're a low-life nobody?"
"That's not true."
"If your father is Helios, prove it. Ask him to come down here."
Phaethon looked up at the sun, which you should never do without proper eye protection, as Phaethon's mother had told him a million times. Silently, he prayed to his father for a sign.
"Come on," Epiphas goaded him. "Make the sun zigzag for us. Make it do loops. My chariot can do wheelies at 60 miles an hour, and the horn plays La Cucaracha. Surely the sun can do better than that."
The crowd howled with delight. "Please, Dad," Phaethon pleaded. "Help me out here." For a second, he thought the sun might be getting a little brighter, but no, nothing. Phaethon ran away in shame.
"That's right, shiny boy," the prince yelled after him. "Run home to your mommy and sisters. They probably have your bib and baby food ready."
When Phaethon got home, he slammed the door of his room. He turned up his music too loud and threw his textbooks against the wall over and over. Okay, I'm just guessing about that. But when I'm in a bad mood, nothing feels quite as good as turning fun with algebraic equations into a destructo frisbee. Phaethon's seven sisters gathered outside his door, asking him what was wrong. When he wouldn't answer, they ran to get their mother. Finally, Clymene got Phaethon to come out. He told her what had happened with Prince Epiphas. "Oh, honey," Clymene said, "I wish you would wear sunscreen when you go to the racetrack." "Mom, you're missing the point." "Sorry, dear. Would you like a grilled cheese sandwich? That always makes you feel better." "I don't want a grilled cheese sandwich. I want some proof that my father is Helios." Clymene wrung her hands. She had always suspected this day would come. She'd done her best to keep her son safe, but stern warnings and protective padding could only go so far. Sooner or later, trouble always finds a demigod. Trust me on that. She decided to try one last thing to placate him. "Come with me," she said. She led Phaethon outside. In the middle of the street, Clymene raised her arms to the afternoon sun sinking behind the palm trees. "Hear me, O gods," she shouted. "My child, Phaethon, is the son of Helios, lord of the sun." "Mom," Phaethon muttered, "you're embarrassing me." "If what I say is a lie," Clymene kept shouting, "let Helios strike me down with a bolt of fire." Nothing happened. It would have been kind of cool if Helios had reacted one way or the other, but gods don't like being told what to do, even if it's something fun like striking people with bolts of fire. Clymene smiled. "You see, my son? I'm still alive." "That's not much proof," Phaethon muttered. "I want to meet my dad. I want to hear the truth from him." Clemene's heart felt close to breaking. She realized it was time to let her son choose his own path, but she didn't want to. She wanted to wrap him in blankets and store him safely forever in a box of styrofoam peanuts. "Oh, Phaethon, please don't. It's a dangerous journey to the palace of Helios." "So you know the way. Tell me." Clymene sighed. "If you must go, walk due east toward the horizon. At the end of the third night, you will reach the palace of the sun. Only travel at night, not during the day." "Because during the day, my dad is driving his chariot across the sky. He's only home at night." "Right," said Clymene. "Also, it's really hot during the day. You'll get dehydrated." "Mom!" "Just be careful, dear. Don't do anything rash." Phaethon had heard warnings like this a million times, so it just rolled right off his safety helmet. "Thank you, Mother!" He kissed her goodbye. Then he hugged each of his seven sisters, who wept to see him go off alone without travel immunizations, water tablets, or even training wheels. As soon as he was out of sight, Phaethon threw away his safety helmet. Then he ventured off to find the Palace of the Sun, where he was sure he would win fame and glory. Fame? Yeah. Glory? Not so much. For three nights, he walked east from the Nile River. Now, if most people did that, they'd run into the Red Sea and a whole bunch of fancy beach resorts. Phaethon, being the son of Helios, managed to find his father's magical palace at the edge of the horizon, where every day Helios started his cruise for hot chicks. I mean his glorious ascent into the sky. Phaethon arrived at about 3 a.m. Even in the pre-dawn darkness, he had to put on his sunglasses to deal with the blazing light of the palace. The parapets glowed like molten gold. Flames encircled the celestial bronze columns that lined the facade. Etched on the silver gates, designed by Hephaestus himself, were scenes of mortal life that moved like video images. As Phaethon approached, the doors swung open. Inside was an audience chamber the size of a sports arena. Various minor gods, the court attendants of Helios, mixed and mingled while they waited to start their daily duties. The three Ore, the goddesses of the seasons, sipped coffee and ate breakfast tacos. A lady in shimmering blue and gold robes, Hemera, the goddess of day, chatted with a beautiful winged girl in a rose-colored gown. Faith and guessed she must be Eos, the rosy-fingered goddess of the dawn, because she had the reddest hands he'd ever seen. Either that or she'd been finger-painting with blood, in which case Phaethon didn't want to know. In another corner stood a whole crowd of guys in matching blue overalls with different times painted on their backs. 12 p.m., 1 a.m., 4 p.m., and the words scrub tub. Phaethon guessed they were the gods of the hours. Yeah, every hour of the day had a minor god. Can you imagine being the god of 2 p.m.? All the school kids would hate you. They'd be like, can it please be 3:30? I want to go home. In the center of the room, the Titan Helios sat on a throne constructed entirely of emeralds. No, he wasn't showy at all. Dude probably had a toilet made out of diamonds, too. You'd go blind every time you flushed it. His purple robes showed off his tan. A wreath of gold laurels crowned his dark hair. He smiled warmly. Well, he was the sun. He did everything warmly, which helped offset the creepiness of his eyes. His pupils blazed like pilot lights for industrial ovens.
Phaethon, he called. Welcome, my son.
My son. Those two words made Phaethon's entire life. Pride filled him with warmth. Or maybe he was just getting a fever from the throne room, where the thermostat was set to, like, 120. So it's true? He asked in a small voice. I am your son?
Of course you are, said Helios. Come here. Let me look at you.
Phaethon approached the throne. The other gods gathered around, whispering comments like, he's got his dad's nose.
Nice posture. Handsome young man. Too bad he doesn't have flaming eyes.
Phaethon felt dizzy. He wondered if coming there was such a good idea. Then he remembered Epiphos making fun of him, doubting his parentage. Stupid prince with his stupid lowrider chariot. Phaethon's anger gave him renewed courage. He was a demigod. He had every right to be here. He stood up straight and met his father's blazing eyes. Helios regarded his son.
You have grown into a fine young man. You deserve the name The Shining. And by that, I mean you are young and strong and handsome. Not that you are associated in any way with that Psycho Axe murderer movie.
Thanks.
So, my son, said the god, why have you come to see me?
A bead of sweat trickled down Phaethon's cheek. He was tempted to answer, because you never come to see me, you jerk. But he guessed that wouldn't go over too well. Father, I'm proud to be your son, Phaethon said. But back home, no one believes me. They laugh at me. They claim I'm lying. Helios scowled.
Why don't they believe you? Didn't they notice that I refrained from incinerating your mother when she made that oath?
I don't think that convinced anyone.
Don't they know that your name means the shining?
They don't care.
Mortals! There's no pleasing them.
Helios brooded. He hated the idea of his kid getting teased at the racetrack. He wanted to help Phaethon, but he wasn't sure how. He should have gone for something easy, like a signed note or a father and son photo on Instagram. Maybe he could have dragged a promotional banner behind the sun chariot.
Phaethon is my son. Deal with it.
Instead, Helios did something rash.
To prove I am your father, said the god, ask me one favor, anything at all, and I will grant it.
Phaethon's eyes lit up, not literally like his dad's, but almost that bright. Really? Do you mean it? Helios chuckled.
Kids today.
He figured Phaethon would ask him for a magic sword or NASCAR tickets or something.
I promise on the River Styx.
There it is again, that promise you should never make, and which gods and heroes always seem to blurt out at the worst possible moment. I understand why Helios did it, though. Like a lot of godly dads, and mortal dads too, he felt guilty about not spending enough time with his kids. He tried to compensate with an expensive present. In this case, a way stupid promise. Phaethon didn't hesitate. Ever since he was a little boy, he'd wanted only one thing. He'd dreamed of it his whole life. "I want to drive the sun chariot tomorrow," he announced, "for one day all by myself." A record needle scratching noise filled the throne room as all the gods whipped their necks around like, "Say what?" Helios's godly jaw dropped. His godly butt felt uncomfortable on his emerald throne.
"Whoa, whoa, whoa."
He tried for a laugh, but it sounded more like somebody choking to death.
"Kid, let's not go crazy here. Pick something else. Seriously, that's the only thing I can't give you."
"You promised anything," Phaethon said. "You didn't put an asterisk next to it."
"The asterisk was implied. Come on, kid. The sun chariot. It's too dangerous. How about a nice set of matchbox chariots?"
"Dad, I'm 16.
"A real chariot, then. I'll give you one that's way better than all the other kids. The Mark V Zephyr has bronze radials and..."
"Dad," said Phaethon, "will you honor your promise or not?" Helios felt trapped. Worse than the time he blew a wheel at 4 o'clock and was stuck waiting for roadside assistance in the middle of the afternoon sky.
"Phaethon, okay, I promised. I can't back out, but I can try to talk some sense into you. This is a bad idea. If there was a god of bad ideas, he'd paint letting a mortal drive the sun chariot on his shield because it's the ultimate bad idea."
Phaethon's excitement didn't waver. For 16 years, his mother and sisters had been telling him that everything he wanted to do was a bad idea. Too dangerous, too risky. He wasn't going to be dissuaded now. "Let me drive the sun chariot," he said. "It's the only thing I've ever wanted. It's my dream."
"But son..."
Helios looked around at his courtly attendants for help, but they were all suddenly very interested in their breakfast tacos.
"Nobody can handle the heat of the chariot except me. Even Zeus couldn't do it, and he's the most powerful god of all. My 4 horses are almost impossible to control. Then there's the course. At first you climb straight up, like the craziest roller coaster ever. At the top, you're so high up, you're scraping against the heavens, and all those starry constellation monsters might attack you. Then there's the descent, which is the most terrifying, super horrible adrenaline rush. I'm not convincing you, am I?"
"It sounds awesome," Phaethon said. "When can I start?"
"Let me drive you instead. You can ride shotgun and wave and throw candy."
"No, Dad."
"Let me train you for a few months before you take the reins, or a few centuries. Going tomorrow, that's nuts."
"No." Helios heaved a sigh.
"You're breaking my heart, kid. All right. Come on."
The sun garage wasn't one of those garages that get crammed with storage boxes, broken furniture, and old Christmas decorations. The marble floor was spotless. The horse stables were freshly scrubbed. The pit crew of our gods rushed around in their matching scrub tub uniforms, polishing the chariot's trim, vacuuming the interior, and yoking the elephant-sized fiery horses to the draft pole. The chariot's wheels stood twice as tall as Phaethon. The axle and rims were solid gold, with silver spokes and Maserati brake pads. The sides of the carriage were inlaid with Hephaestus's metalwork, fluid images of Mount Olympus in various hues of gold, silver, and bronze. The black leather interior had a tricked-out stereo system, 24-karat drink holders, and a pine tree-shaped deodorizer hanging from the rearview mirror. Phaethon was anxious to climb aboard, but when he grabbed the rails, the metal burned like a stovetop.
"Hold up."
His father took out a bottle of what looked like sunscreen.
Let me put this on you so you don't burst into flames.
Phaethon squirmed impatiently while Helios applied magic lotion to his face and arms. He'd had to go through this when he was little. While all the other kids were playing on the banks of the Nile, his mom would slather him up and give him stupid lectures about the dangers of sunstroke or crocodiles or whatever. So annoying.
There, said Helios. That should prevent instant death. Once the wheels start turning, the chariot's temperature goes up to about 300 degrees, and that's inside with the AC on full blast.
It can't be that hot, Phaethon said, though his palms were covered with blisters.
Listen, kid, we don't have much time before sunrise. I'll try to give you some tips to save your life.
Whoa! Phaethon climbed into the carriage and ran to the dashboard. You have built-in Bluetooth?
Phaethon, please.
Helios jumped in next to him, just in time to stop him from firing the rocket thrusters.
Don't touch the buttons. And whatever you do, don't whip the horses to go faster.
There's a whip? Cool! Phaethon grabbed it from its holster. He flicked the golden lash, and tongues of fire curled into the air.
Don't use it, Helios pleaded. The horses will go plenty fast enough. By the way, their names are Blaze, Dawn, Fire, and Flame. Don't call them Donner, Blitzen, Comet, and Cupid. They hate that.
Why?
Never mind. If you have to slow them down, use the reins. Keep a firm hand, or they'll know you're inexperienced. They'll start to misbehave.
Oh, please, said Phaethon. These horses look like sweethearts. The stallions shook their fiery manes. They exhaled plumes of volcanic ash and clopped their hooves, scorching the marble floor.
Sure, Helios said. Most important, stick to the middle of the sky. Once you're up there, you'll see my tracks, kind of like vapor trail skid marks. Follow those. The horses know the way. Don't go too high, or you'll set the heavens on fire. Don't go too low, or you'll destroy the earth.
Got it.
Don't go too far north or too far south. The middle of the sky. As long as you do that and you don't do anything stupid, there's a small percent chance you might live.
To Phaethon, all of this was the usual blah, blah, blah. His mom and sisters had been lecturing him since the beginning of time. All he could think about was that sweet fiery whip, those awesome smoking horses, and how epic he would look driving this golden chariot into the morning sky. The alarm tone went off on Helios's smartphone.
Here comes the sun.
He climbed out of the carriage. The dawn goddess Eos ran into the garage. She hit a button on the wall, and the garage door rolled up. A spotlight switched on, illuminating the early morning sky. Eos put her rosy-colored hands over the light and started making shadow puppet designs. Phaethon had never realized the daily sunrise was such a weird gig.
Last chance, Helios implored his son. Please don't do this.
I'll be fine, Dad. Jeez, I'll bring your chariot back, not a scratch.
No loud music. And keep your hands on the reins. And if you have to parallel park,
see you, Dad. Thanks. Phaethon flicked the reins.
Giddy up!
The horses lurched forward, pulling Phaethon and the chariot into the sky as Helios yelled after him.
The insurance card is in the glove compartment.
The ride was even more awesome than Phaethon had imagined. He whooped and hollered and did his happy dance as the chariot shot upward at a billion miles an hour.
Yeah, baby! He shouted. Who's the sun? I'm the sun!
The horses were already going crazy. Blaze, Dawn, Fire, and Flame didn't appreciate how lightly Phaethon held their reins. They weren't big fans of his happy dance either. They ran at twice their normal speed. But since they were climbing straight up, and since Phaethon had never driven the chariot before, he didn't realize anything was wrong. The folks down on Earth must have noticed, though. They woke up at like 6 a.m. 20 minutes later, it was lunchtime. The chariot leveled out at the top of the sky. Phaethon's excitement started to level out, too. He gazed at all the dashboard buttons he wasn't supposed to push. He kept one hand on the reins and rummaged through his dad's CDs, looking for some non-lame music, but the selection was hopeless. Good Day Sunshine, Walking on Sunshine, You Are the Sunshine of My Life. The sun-related oldies just kept on coming. Phaethon tried to concentrate on the smoky trail of wheel marks across the sky, following them the way his dad had told him to. But that got monotonous after, like, 5 minutes. Besides, even with the AC on full blast, even with his magical sunscreen, the chariot was hot. Soon Phaethon felt sweaty and cranky and fidgety.
"I'm bored," Phaethon said. "This is boring."
That may sound unbelievable, but I can relate. Most demigods are ADHD. No matter how awesome or terrifying an experience, after a few minutes, we're ready for something else. Still, when you're hurtling through the stratosphere in a million-degree fiery death chariot saying,
"I'm bored,"
might be tempting fate just a teensy bit. Phaethon looked down at the earth far below. The view was scary amazing. He'd never been so high up. No mortal had, since this was before airplanes and whatnot. He was pretty sure he could make out the blue line of the Nile River. His hometown would be in the middle, right about there. "Hey, Epiphos!" he shouted down. "How do you like this ride?" But of course Epiphos couldn't hear him. Nobody at home would know Phaethon was driving the sun. In a few days, after the most thrilling experience in his life, Phaethon would return and brag about it, and no one would believe him. He'd be right back where he started, ridiculed, shunned, forced to wear a safety helmet and a life jacket for the rest of his sheltered, boring life. "Unless," he grinned, "unless I did something unusual that would prove it was me driving the chariot." The horses had reached the zenith of their path. The sky above was black. The air was thin, but I don't think you can blame a lack of oxygen for what Phaethon did next. His fatal flaw was recklessness. That's pretty obvious. Sure, you can accuse his mom and sisters of being overprotective. Maybe their obsessive worrying made Phaethon reckless, or maybe they understood him well enough to know what would happen if they ever stopped looking out for him. Whatever the case, Phaethon decided it would be a great idea to fly low enough over his hometown so that he could shout to the folks and make it clear he was in the driver's seat. "Dive!" he told the horses. The horses were already running way too fast. They were confused and annoyed that their driver didn't have his normal steady hand on the reins. But they knew their usual path, and they stubbornly stuck to it. Phaethon grabbed the whip. He flicked it, lashing tongues of fire across the horses' backsides. "Dive!" The horses snorted and whinnied like, "You asked for it, buddy!" They dove. Fortunately, Phaethon's left hand was wrapped around the reins. Otherwise, he would have flown out the back of the chariot along with the whip, the floor mats, and his dad's CD collection. He screamed as he became the first human to experience zero G, but part of him was thrilled. He could see his town clearly now, the houses, the palace, and the racetrack all coming into focus as he hurtled toward the earth. "They're going to notice me!" he shouted. They noticed, all right. Their first clue was when the palm trees burst into flames. Then the Nile River began to boil. The thatched roofs of the houses caught fire. Phaethon watched in horror as the entire northern part of Africa, which had always been green and lush, withered and burned, turning into a vast desert. "No," he murmured. "No, no, no! Up! Go up! Comet or Blitzen or whatever your names are!" The horses didn't like that. They bucked and turned, shaking the chariot from side to side, hoping to spill their stupid teenage driver. More by luck than design, they banked up into the north. They climbed into the sky above Europe. As they got higher, the northern parts of the continent began to freeze. Snow collected on the mountaintops. Glaciers expanded across the landscape, swallowing entire towns. The temperature inside the chariot became uncomfortably cool, which was not good, considering it was supposed to be 300 degrees. Frost formed on the yokes of the horses. Their fiery breath turned to steam. Stars appeared in the midday sky, monstrous constellations in the shapes of a rampaging bull, a coiled serpent, a scorpion poised to strike. I'm not sure what Phaethon saw up there in space, but it drove him mad with terror. He realized, too late, that he should never have asked to drive this chariot. He wished he'd never been born.
"Please," he prayed, "just let me go back to my family. I'll never misbehave again."
Down on the earth, the mortals were praying, too. The shortest morning in history had turned into the longest, worst afternoon ever. The southern parts of the earth were scorched and barren. The northern parts were frozen and icy. People were dying. Crops were burning. People's vacation plans were ruined. Meteorologists were curled into fetal position on the TV studio floor, sobbing and cackling hysterically. According to some versions of the story, Phaethon's little joyride also burned the people of Africa, so their skin became darker. I don't know about that. I guess the Greeks were trying to explain why people have different skin colors, but I think it's just as likely that humans were originally dark, and some god of laundry washed the Europeans with Clorox by accident, and they got all bleached out. Anyway, Phaethon was now totally out of control. The sun did loops through the sky and zigzagged around. The mortals screamed prayers to the king of the gods.
"Hey, Zeus! We're dying down here! A little help?"
Zeus was sitting in his throne room, engrossed in the latest issue of GQ, God Quarterly. But when he heard so many humans calling his name, he glanced out the window.
"Holy me!"
He saw cities burning. People dying, seas boiling, his temples crumbling to dust.
"My temples? No! Who's driving the sun?"
He used his super godly vision to zoom in on the chariot. He quickly realized that the scrawny dude at the reins was not Helios.
"Oh, I hate student drivers. Hey, Ganymede, get in here."
The king's cupbearer poked his head around the corner.
"Yeah, boss?"
"Bring me one of my lightning bolts. They're over by the end table in the hallway next to my keys."
"What size lightning bolt?"
"Bring me a number 10.
Ganymede's eyes widened. Zeus hardly ever busted out the number 10s. They were for special occasions, like weddings and Armageddon. A minute later, Ganymede came back lugging a celestial bronze cylinder the size of a booster rocket. Zeus hefted it and took careful aim. He would need to hit the driver without destroying the chariot. He wasn't sure what would happen if he blew up the sun, but he doubted it would be good. Still, that chariot was out of control. It was destroying his temples and some of his favorite statues of himself. Drastic measures were called for. Phaethon's last thought as he was blasted out of the sky, Though maybe, just a little, he was also thinking, "Thank the gods." At the end, he knew his joyride had to stop. He was endangering his family and the entire human race. He was scared out of his mind. No roller coaster can go on forever, even a super terrifying adrenaline rush of fiery doom. A bright flash, and it was all over for Phaethon. Zeus knocked the kid clean out of the chariot. His body fell to earth as a fiery comet. Without their annoying driver, the horses dragged the sun chariot back to their stables. Blaze, Dawn, Fire, and Flame figured they would be rewarded for a good day's work with fiery carrots and molten oats. After the day of the loopy sun, life was never the same. The gods held an emergency council to review safety regulations for drivers. Helios mourned his son. His heart turned bitter. Rather than blaming himself for letting Phaethon drive, he blamed Zeus for killing the boy. Funny how gods, and people, do that sometimes.
"I will never drive the sun again," Helios declared. Let someone else take over this stupid job.
Maybe that's when people started thinking of Apollo as the sun god, because Helios quit without unemployment benefits or a severance package or anything. Or maybe the gods pleaded and threatened, and Helios kept his job for a while longer. Either way, Helios never again let one of his kids borrow the car or mess with his CD collection. As for Phaethon's burning body, his poor mother and seven sisters watched it fall past the northern horizon. Clymene knew her son was dead. No one survived Zeus's lightning. But the seven Heliades decided they couldn't rest until they found their brother's body. For months, they traveled until they arrived in the wilds of northern Italy. There, near the swampy mouth of the Po River, they found their brother's final resting place. Zeus's lightning had somehow turned the demigod into a never-ending fuel source. His body smoldered and smoked, but never disintegrated. He had plunged into a small lake and become lodged at the bottom. There he lay, boiling eternally, heating the lake and generating bubbles of noxious gas that popped on the surface and made the whole area poisonous. Even birds that flew over the lake would drop dead. The seven Heliades stood at the shore and wept. There was no way they could retrieve Phaethon's body, but they refused to leave. They wouldn't eat or drink. Finally, Zeus took pity on them. Even though Phaethon had been kind of an idiot, the king of the gods appreciated the sisters' loyalty to their brother.
"You will stay with him forever," Zeus decided. "You will stand as a reminder of what happened on the day of the loopy sun."
The sisters changed shape. Their clothes hardened into tree bark. Their toes elongated, turning into roots. Their hair stretched out, reaching skyward to become branches and leaves. Their tears became golden sap, which hardened into amber. That's why the Greeks called amber the stone of light, because it was formed from the tears of the daughters of the sun. Today, nobody knows exactly where that lake is. Maybe it sank into the sea or the marshes. But back in the day, maybe 100 years after the loopy sun incident, another hero named Jason sailed up the River Po on his ship, the Argo. During the night, he heard the trees weeping, a ghostly wail that drove his crew insane with fear. The fumes from the lake were as poisonous as ever. An eerie golden light glowed at the bottom of the lake, where the body of Phaethon still smoldered. But we'll talk more about Jason later. Anyway, now you know why Phaethon never got his driver's license. Moral of the story? Destroying the earth will get you pulled over real fast. Or maybe, don't make stupid promises to your kid. Or maybe, if your mom seems overprotective, it's possible she knows you better than you think. I had to put that in there. My mom is nodding and muttering, "Thank you." So, that's Phaethon. A nice, unhappy ending with tons of death. Feel better? Good. Because we're not done yet. The male heroes didn't have a monopoly on carnage and destruction. Let's go out to Amazon country and meet a sweetheart of a killer named Atrera. Atrera invents the Amazons, with free 2-day shipping. We don't know much about Atrera from the old stories. Those ancient Greek dudes didn't care where Atrera came from or what made her tick. Why would that be? 1, she was a woman. 2, she was a scary woman. 3, she was a scary woman who killed ancient Greek dudes. Originally, she lived in the northern lands around the Black Sea, the same general area that would later produce great humanitarians like Attila the Hun. Who were Atrera's people? We don't know. That's probably because she killed them all. We just know that at some point she decided her life as a Bronze Age housewife sucked. She decided to do something about it. Maybe you're wondering, what would make an average lady go crazy, kill all the men of her tribe, and found a nation of homicidal women? Did I mention that being a Bronze Age housewife sucked? If you were a woman back then, this was your best-case scenario. You might be born in Sparta. Anytime Sparta is your best-case scenario, you are truly stranded up Poop Creek without a paddle. At least in Sparta, women could own property. They were respected as the mothers of warriors. Young girls could serve as acolytes in the Temple of Artemis and, to please the goddess, help whip the male human sacrifices so their blood stained the altar. For more details, see Spartans, Complete Freakazoids. If you are born female in Athens, the cradle of democracy, you are almost as bad off as a slave. And yeah, they had slaves. You couldn't own property. You couldn't vote in the assembly. You couldn't run a business. You weren't even supposed to go to the agora, the community market and outdoor mall, though a lot of women did anyway, because, you know, the lemon chicken at the food court was pretty tasty. Basically, women couldn't do anything except stay home, cook food, clean house, and look pretty, preferably all at the same time. Now me, being an awesome modern demigod dude, I could do all that easily, but not everybody can pull it off. My girlfriend Annabeth is reading this over my shoulder and laughing. Why are you laughing? Athenian women couldn't even choose who they married. That was true for most women back then. When you were a child, your parents were your guardians. Read, your dad was your guardian because your mom was just there to teach you how to clean and cook and look pretty. Your father made all your decisions for you. Oh, you don't like his decisions? Well, your options are getting beaten, killed, or sold into slavery. Take your time choosing. Once you were old enough to marry, and by that I mean like 12 or 13, your dad would pick your husband for you. The lucky guy might be older. He might be ugly. He might be fat. But don't worry, your dad would make sure your husband had the proper social standing so it would reflect well on your dad's reputation. Your dad would pay your husband a dowry, a price for taking you. In exchange, your husband would be your dad's ally in his political and business dealings. So, while you're sitting at home, cooking and looking pretty for your old, ugly, fat husband, you can take comfort in knowing it was the best match for your father's interests. As a married woman, your husband became your guardian. He made all the decisions for you, just like your dad used to do. Oh, you don't like his decisions? See your options for punishment above. Starting to feel like a homicidal woman yet? Then maybe you can understand what motivated Atrera. Because the stuff I just described for Athens and Sparta, in the northern lands, where Atrera was born, life was harsher and conditions for women were 10 times worse. When Atrera snapped, she snapped in a big way. Ever since she was a kid, Atrera's favorite gods were Artemis and Ares. Artemis was the protector of young maidens, so that makes sense. Artemis didn't need no stinking man to take care of her, which appealed to Atrera. If her people were anything like the Spartans, I bet when Atrera was young, she served as a junior priestess for Artemis. I can totally see her whipping human sacrifice guys until they bled all over the altar. Hey, she would have thought, this whipping men and making them bleed? This is fun. Atrera didn't want to become a full-time follower of Artemis, though. That would have meant swearing off men forever. Nuh-uh. Atrera liked guys, when they weren't ordering her around. Later, she would have plenty of boyfriends. She even gave birth to a couple of daughters. More on that in a sec. Her other favorite god was Ares, the war dude. A god like Ares made sense to Atrera. She lived in the harsh country. Life was brutal. You want something, you kill for it. You get angry. You punch someone in the face. Simple, direct, bloody, fun. Like most places back then, Atrera's town was controlled by men. Women had no rights. They definitely weren't allowed to fight, but at some point, Atrera got frustrated being her husband's laundress slash cook slash floor scrubber slash eye candy. She decided to teach herself self-defense just in case, well, in case she needed it someday. At night, she sneaked off into the woods with her husband's sword and bow. She taught herself to spar by hacking at trees, imitating the moves she'd seen the young male soldiers use. She taught herself to shoot until she could take down a wild animal in the dark at 200 yards. Once Atrera felt confident in her abilities, she sought out other townswomen who were just as frustrated as she was. They were tired of their old, smelly, fat husbands telling them what to do, beating them, or killing them, or selling them into slavery if they complained. Atrera secretly began teaching her friends how to fight. In the woods at night, they learned the hunting skills of Artemis, but they also prayed to Ares for strength and courage in battle. Worshipping both gods together was an unusual mix, like, Artemis tells us men are stupid brutes, therefore let us worship Ares, the stupidest manly brute of all. But the combo was effective. Atrera and her followers soon became vicious and fearless. For a while, they pretended everything was normal at home. Then one day, something happened that made Atrera go nuclear. I don't know what. Maybe her husband ordered her to get him a beer from the fridge one too many times. Maybe he yelled at her for not being pretty enough while she was scrubbing the floor. Atrera calmly retrieved her husband's sword from the closet. She hid the blade behind her skirts and walked over to where her husband was sitting. "I want a divorce," she said. Her husband belched.
"You can't have a divorce. I make all the decisions for you. You belong to me. Also, nobody has invented divorce yet."
"I just did." Atrera whipped out the sword and cut off her husband's head. He never asked her for another beer, but he did get blood all over the floor that Atrera had just finished mopping. She hated it when that happened. Her sword in hand, Atrera stepped outside her hut. She made a cawing sound like a raven, the sacred bird of Ares. Her followers heard the signal. They retrieved their swords and daggers and meat cleavers, and being a man suddenly became the most dangerous occupation in town. Most of the males were either killed or put in chains. A few lucky ones escaped. They ran to the nearest town and explained what had happened. You can imagine how that conversation went.
"My wife pulled a sword on me."
"And you ran away?"
"She was crazy. The ladies killed everyone."
"Your housewives killed all your best warriors? What kind of men are you? We'll go teach them a lesson." The guys from the neighboring town marched to Atrera's village, but they didn't take the expedition very seriously. After all, they were going to fight women. They figured they'd walk in, administer a few spankings, have a few beers, then take the prettiest women as slaves and go home. It didn't work out that way. Atrera had set tripwires and snares along the road. She'd built a barricade at the gates, fully manned, or womaned, by her best archers and sword fighters. The guys showed up. Atrera's followers slaughtered them. Atrera marched to the neighboring town. She liberated the women, recruiting those who wanted to join her and letting the rest go free. The remaining men she killed or enslaved. A few terrified survivors fled to nearby villages, spreading the word about the crazy woman Atrera and her band of merry murderesses. The next town's men tried to stop her. Her warriors slaughtered them. Rinse and repeat. Soon, Atrera found herself in control of a dozen towns with a fledgling army of vicious women ready to follow her to glory. They were highly motivated to fight, because if they ever lost, their male enemies would have no mercy. The women wouldn't be treated as prisoners of war. They'd be beaten, sold as slaves, and then killed. The whole trifecta. Atrera was still learning how to organize her troops when the menfolk of the neighboring cities started to take her seriously. The men mustered an actual, no-nonsense army. Thousands of hardened veterans with real weapons and no illusions about beer and spankings. Atrera's scouts warned her what was up.
"We need more time," Atrera said. "We haven't trained our women properly. Besides, this country is harsh and barren, and it really sucks. It's not worth defending. Let's migrate to a richer land and carve out our own queendom."
That sounded a lot better to her followers than an all-out war they might not win. The entire tribe of warrior women,
along with their slaves and captured loot, their children, and their barnyard animals, and their favorite knickknacks, migrated to the other side of the Black Sea, to the northern coast of what is now Turkey. Glory awaited them. Also, a whole lot of blood and some flesh-eating birds. Atrera founded a new capital city called Sinope, near the Thermodon River. She trained her armies and gathered recruits, gradually expanding her territory and discovering where all the best restaurants were. She'd set up her kingdom in a good spot, northeast of the Greeks, northwest of Persians, in what was a no-man's land. Get it? No men? Whenever she conquered a new town, she was careful to leave no male survivors. That way, word was slow getting out. By the time her neighbors figured out she was a threat, it was too late. The new nation was firmly entrenched. They raised their terrible banner, a stick figure guy with a big X through him. They became known and feared across the world as the Amazons. Why were they called Amazons? Nobody's sure. It doesn't have anything to do with the Amazon River down in Brazil. Man, that confused me for years before Annabeth set me straight. I had this image of women warriors hanging out in the rainforest with parrots and monkeys and piranhas. The ancient Amazons also have nothing to do with any modern company that might have the name Amazon, nor is that company a secret front for their plans for world domination. Cough. Yeah, right. Cough. Some Greeks thought the name Amazon came from the word Amazos, which means without a breast. They somehow got the idea, serious gross-out alert, that Amazon women removed their own right breasts so they could shoot a bow and throw a spear better. Okay, first of all, no. Just no. That's not only gross, it's dumb. Why would the Amazons do that? I mean, yeah, they were serious battle-hardened killers, but you can shoot a bow or throw a spear just fine without, you know. Also, if you look at any ancient statue or picture of the Amazons, there's no evidence that the Amazons were, lopsided. Finally, I have met Amazons myself. They are not into hurting themselves unnecessarily. Other people? Sure, but not themselves. A few Greek writers realized this was a bonehead theory. One dude, Herodotus, called Atrera's people the Androctones instead, which means man-killers. Homer called them the Antianeiri, meaning those who fight like men. Both of those terms are a lot more accurate than those who did a big owie so they could shoot a bow better. Me? I like the theory that Amazon comes from the Persian term Hamazon, which means warriors. I like that theory because Annabeth likes that theory, and if I don't like what she likes, she gets all Hamazon on me. Anyway, the Amazons had arrived, loud and proud. They got stronger and more numerous as they raised their next generation of girls to think and act like warriors. You're wondering, wait, it was a nation of all women. How did they have a next generation? Where did all the cute little Amazon killer babies come from? Well, the Amazons had male slaves. I mentioned that, right? Some of those guys became the first house husbands, and they had just as many rights and privileges as women did in other countries, meaning none. Real nice. Also, the Amazons had this weird arrangement with a neighboring tribe called the Gargarians. The Gargarians lived on the opposite side of this huge mountain northeast of Amazon country. They were an all-male tribe, which I don't get. Seriously, a tribe made entirely of dudes? You know the laundry never got done. The living room was a disaster zone, and the leftovers in the fridge smelled worse than Phaethon Lake gas. You'd think an all-male tribe would be the Amazon's worst enemy, but apparently not. Ever heard the old saying, good fences make good neighbors? Me neither. According to Annabeth, it means something like, don't touch my stuff and we'll get along fine. In the case of the Gargarians and the Amazons, a big mountain made excellent neighbors. The two groups never bothered each other. Once a year, by mutual agreement, They had a big potluck dinner and sleepover party on the mountaintop. Amazons got chummy with Gargarians, and what do you know? About 9 months later, a whole lot of Amazons had cute little killer babies. They kept the girls and raised them to be the next generation of warriors. The boys? Well, who needed the boys? The Amazons sent the strongest and healthiest ones to the Gargarians to raise. If Atrera thought the baby was too sickly and weak, he's a baby, how can he not be weak? She would leave the little guy in the wilderness, exposed on a rock, and let nature take its course. Harsh and cruel? Yep. Life was a lot of fun back then. Atrera led her warriors on tons of successful campaigns across Asia Minor and into Greece. They founded two famous cities on the western coast of Turkey, Smyrna and Ephesus. Why they picked those names, I don't know. I would have gone with Butt-Kickville and Smackdown City, but that's just me. They fought the Greeks so many times that if you go to Athens today, you'll see tons of pictures of the Greek Amazon Wars. The pictures always show the Greeks winning, but that's just wishful thinking. Truth was, the Amazons scared the cheese whiz out of the Greeks. Atrera's warriors enslaved men. They fought like demons, and they definitely did not cook you dinner or scrub your floor. Pretty soon, the Amazon forces were so widespread they split into different tribes. Franchise towns started popping up all over the place. The ancient Greek writers got confused when they tried to describe where the Amazons lived.
They're over there. No, they're over there. They're everywhere.
Atrera was still queen of the whole enchilada. I'm pretty sure that was her official title. She ruled from her capital of Sinope. And if she called for a war, all the Amazon factions obeyed. You didn't want to get on Atrera's bad side. Unfortunately, when dealing with men, that was the only side she had. Okay, I take that back. She did fall in love with a guy once. Their romance was uglier than any wartime massacre. One day, Atrera had just finished a hard day's work killing the neighbors. She and her warriors were walking along the shores of the Black Sea after a battle, looting dead bodies, enslaving survivors, when a red flash illuminated the clouds.
"You do nice work," a deep voice rumbled from the sky. "Meet me at the island on the horizon. We have things to discuss."
The Amazons weren't easy to scare, but that voice freaked them out. One of the queen's lieutenants glanced at her. "You're not going, are you?" Atrera gazed across the water. Sure enough, a dark splotch of land was just visible on the horizon. "Yes," she decided. "A flash of red light and a strange voice over the battlefield. Either we are all hallucinating from last night's casserole, or that was the god Ares talking. I better go see what he wants." Atrera rowed a boat to the island alone. On the shore stood the god Ares, 7 feet tall in full bronze combat armor, with a flaming spear in his hand. His cloak was the color of blood. His boots were speckled with mud and gore, because he loved to tap dance over the corpses of his enemies. His face was ruggedly handsome, if you liked that killer Neanderthal look. His eyes glowed with pure, fiery carnage.
"Atrera, we meet at last," he said. "Dang, girl, you're fine."
Atrera's knees shook. It's not every day you meet one of your favorite gods. But she didn't bow or kneel. She was done bowing to men, even Ares. Also, she figured the war god would prefer a show of strength. "You're not bad yourself," she said. "I like those boots."
"Thanks," Ares grinned. "I got them at the army surplus store down in Sparta. They had this sale, but that's not important. I want you to build me a temple here on this island. You see that big rock?"
"What rock?" Ares raised his spear. The clouds parted. A huge meteorite came hurtling down from space and slammed into the middle of the island. When the steam cleared and the dust settled, a black slab the size of a school bus was sticking upright out of the ground.
"Oh," Atrera said, "that rock."
That's a sacred rock.
Okay.
Praying to the rock is basically a direct line to me. Build a stone temple around it. Every year, bring your Amazons here and sacrifice some of your most important animals.
Those would be our horses, Atrera said. We use them in battle. They give us a huge advantage.
Horses it is, Ares said. Do that for me, and I'll keep blessing you in combat. You'll keep slaughtering people. We'll get along great. What do you say?
Fight me.
Ares stared at her with his nuclear-powered eyes.
What?
We both respect strength. Let's seal the deal with a smackdown.
Wow. I think I'm falling in love with you.
Atrera launched herself with a god. She slugged them across the face. They fell to the ground, kicking, gouging, and doing their best to pulverize each other. It was love at first punch. After they got through fighting, they decided to get married. From that day on, Atrera was known as the Bride of Ares. It did wonders for her street cred. When enemy armies saw her riding toward them, they wet their bronze war breeches. Atrera built a temple on the island, just like Ares had asked. To protect it, Ares sent a flock of killer birds that could shoot their feathers like arrows. Every year, Atrera held a big festival on the island, sacrificing horses and talking to the large black rock. The killer birds didn't bother the Amazons, but if anybody else tried to approach the temple, the birds shot them full of feathers and tore them apart with their sharp beaks. In other words, the temple didn't get a lot of out-of-towners. Ares and Atrera had two daughters, Hippolyta and Penthesilea. Both names quickly shot to the top of the 25 most popular baby girls' names for 1438 BCE list. From then on, Amazon queens and even the Amazons in general were known as the daughters of Ares. Some were literally his daughters. The rest did their best to act like they were. Oh, look, she's got her daddy's smile and his murderous rage. How cute. Ares was happy. The Amazons were happy. But one important person had been left out of the Amazon temple building and deity appreciation program. Artemis, Atrera's other favorite Olympian. Being a smart leader, Atrera figured she'd better show the hunter goddess some gratitude before it started raining silver arrows. Atrera decided to build a temple to Artemis in the city of Ephesus, on the west coast of Turkey. She figured that would make it close enough for the Greeks to visit, since their islands were right across the Aegean Sea. She didn't use arrow-shooting birds this time. Those tended to reduce tourist dollars. Instead, Atrera built the temple on a high hill so it could be seen from all over. She made it as beautiful as possible, with walls of aromatic cedar, floors of polished marble, and ceilings inlaid with gold. In the center of the sanctuary, a statue of Artemis was clad in a dress of amber teardrop ornaments so she glowed when light streamed through the windows. Every year, Atrera hosted a big festival at the temple. The Amazons spent all day partying, doing ferocious war dances through the streets of Ephesus. They sacrificed jewelry to Artemis by draping it over the statue. So by the end of the festival, Artemis looked like a hip-hop fashion model who'd been shopping at King Midas's discount gold warehouse. The temple was a hit. Atrera's greatest legacy. It outlasted her. It outlasted the ancient Greeks. Heck, it almost outlasted the Roman Empire. It was destroyed a couple of times, but the Ephesians always rebuilt it. It was still around in Christian times when a dude named John went there to convert the locals. The place was so famous, it made the list of seven wonders of the ancient world, along with the Egyptian pyramids and, those other ones. The first McDonald's? I forget. The temple paid off for Atrera in more ways than tourist dollars. One time, it saved her and her entire army from death by grapes. How it happened? This new wine god, Dionysus, was rolling through the mortal world with his band of followers, teaching everybody the wonders of partying, drunken savagery, and a good Cabernet with dinner. If your kingdom welcomed Dionysus, great. If you tried to fight him, oops. He was on his way to invade India, because that seemed like a good idea at the time, when he happened through the land of the Amazons. When he met the first Amazon scouting party, he was delighted.
Oh, hey, he said. A nation of women? I can work with that. How about you girls party with us tonight?
The Amazon scout said, sure, why not? They decided they liked wine. They joined Dionysus' group of super fangirls known as the Maenads. Those ladies were mostly nymphs turned into wild, party-hardy assassins who would rip the wine god's enemies to pieces with their bare hands. So imagine what would happen if the Amazons became Maenads. Yeah, kind of like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre with no need for chainsaws. Later, other groups of Amazons tried to stop Dionysus. They weren't going to follow any man, especially since his army included a bunch of satyrs and drunken dudes who smelled like cheap Chardonnay. The Amazons attacked. Dionysus used his godly powers to drive them insane and turn them into grapevines, and then stomp them to make more wine. Atrera heard about these early defeats, some guy claiming to be a god, tromping through her kingdom and stealing her followers or turning them into deciduous fruiting berries. She decided to solve the problem in her usual diplomatic way.
Kill them all, she roared.
She summoned her entire army, which was a pretty impressive sight. Thousands of spears and shields glinted in the sun. Rows of mounted archers, the best cavalry in the world, prepared their flaming arrows. The Amazons could destroy most enemies in a matter of minutes. Their reputation was so terrifying that other kingdoms would hire them as mercenaries to fight their wars. Usually, the other side would